Okay, Deuteronomy, we started last week as an overview to the last book of the Torah. We saw it was actually means second law, and it's not just a repeat of the laws gone on from previous generations, it actually is a reset of the law for a new generation. And we had the picture of a new generation that Moses was on his last legs, he was just about to die, and he was giving the law for a second time to reset a new generation that were going to go into the Jordan River and cross over into the Promised Land. So they're on the brink of a new adventure. Then we fast forwarded 650 years, which is around about the time that the narrator of Deuteronomy was gathering all these informations and stories and bringing them together, redacting them, changing them, editing them, moving them for a new generation that was positioned in Judah that had just heard, or just heard, it was several decades before, that the powerhouse that was Assyria had destroyed and exiled the northern kingdom of Israel, and they were on the verge of taking over, or at least wanting to invade or tempt Judah to sign a treaty of alliance. And the treaty language between a suzerain that then coaches or beckons or persuades a smaller power to sign up to an agreement where the superpower looks after them for obedience and for servitude, then the kingdom of Judah was the vassal, was the smaller entity. And at this point, you've got these two pictures between Moses here on the Jordan River, you've got the narrator here 650 years later, and you've got both groups having different challenges about how to live for God and how to be faithful to God. One that won't be tempted to follow the gods of the Canaanites, and the other that won't be tempted to sign the treaty of Assyria. And they're given a choice. And I want to describe this choice and what we're going to look at is called the Shema in six words. But first, some six words that you may have heard this week. I don't know whether you follow any of Susie Dent's sort of words on the Twitters or X, whatever you want to call it now. She puts out particular Old English words or Scottish words that are particularly pertinent for the move or the cultural stories and news items that are going on. So she said this week, well, perhaps you may have felt this, pseudo-referus. You've all been pseudo-referus this week. Anybody idea? Nobody have an idea what it is. Pseudo-referus.
Pretend something.
Sorry?
Pretend something.
No, it's not, because it's not a... It doesn't begin with P. It begins with S. It is sweaty or sweat-inducing. You may have come across or seen on the news that someone has engaged in boudlerie. Boudleria. Or boudleria. 19th century boudleria. Unprincipled behaviour whilst in public office. And if you've just come back from holiday, you may have engaged in a little bit of gadwaddick. Thank you. a little bit of gadwaddick, James? Oh, suits you, sir. It's to go on a merry adventure. Slightly disappointing, but nevertheless. So a bit of gadwaddick. And then I should imagine that most of you, or want to do this at least, want to do some Herkel Dirkling. No, it's not. No. Herkel Dirkling. It's a Scottish expression.
Drinking outdoors with friends?
No, it's not bad, but it's wrong. No. Herkel Dirkling is to stay in bed longer after it's time to get up. And if you come back from holiday after doing a bit of gadwaddicking, then you may have been doing that. So, yeah, a few words to tempt us to move us into these words in Deuteronomy. And the phrase that we see throughout the whole of Deuteronomy, or the two phrases, or the choice, is choose life. Choose life. And we get to that at the end of Deuteronomy, in Deuteronomy chapters 30 and onwards. And choose life, choose Yahweh, choose idolatry or choose the treaty, choose death or choose blessing, is a binary choice which Deuteronomy gives us. And I'm actually fascinated how the choose life narrative or mandate is reverberates throughout the whole of Deuteronomy, but also how it reverberates in our lives in terms of the choice that God gives us to live faithfully or fruitfully or otherwise. And that is a stark choice that was given for one generation back to the other generation. And the question is, how does choosing life or choosing death, choosing prosperity and choosing blessing actually work out for us? But that's for another week. So we're going to look at the concept of choosing life, but also through the what is called the Shema. And it's in Deuteronomy 6, verses 1 to 9. It's a fairly well-known passage, actually. And it's mainly talking about the positives of choosing Yahweh. So it says, these are the commands, decrees, and laws the Lord your God directed me to teach you to observe in the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess. So that's the first picture that we have on the banks of the River Jordan. So that you, your children, and their children after them may live in awe of the Lord your God as long as you live by keeping all his decrees and commands that he may give you, and so that you may enjoy long life. Listen, O Israel, and be careful to obey, so that it may go well with you, and that you may increase greatly in a land flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord God of your ancestors, promised you. O Israel, listen. The Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commands I give you today are to be on your hearts. So, this is the command, the call, if you like, to choose life and life that is set before them today in terms of their choices of where they're going. And it's a choice which is quite an upscale choice. It's the bright side of things. It is, you may live, you may take hold of the land all the days of your life. Things are going to go well with you if you choose life, if you choose Yahweh. You will multiply, you will become increased throughout the generation. So it just won't be your generation, it'll be countless generations after you. You'll go into the land of milk and honey. It was another name for Eden. It was a way in which the narrator was describing a new promised land, a new garden of opportunities. So this is Moses and God giving the hard sell to these communities, saying, what's not to love and embrace about the choice to choose me, choose Yahweh, rather than those alternatives? You can go back to Eden. You can possess a land. You won't live and die through starvation or through cruelty. You'll have families and you'll have your generations extended. And this is what is known here as the Shema. It's a liturgy that has been read and sung and spoken in Judaism right up until the present day. It's recited twice a day. It's a little bit like our Lord's Prayer that we would perhaps sing or say in churches. It is a liturgy like the Apostles' Creed that people might say as well. So it has a real thread through to our current day. And it is some prominent words about life, but it's also about listening. And you'll be pleased to know it's not alliteration this week. Okay, there are some. So we've had choose life, we've had life, and we've had listen. Now, we've already heard Akram talk about hearing and listening already. And Bethany, a few months ago, gave two sermons on listening and hearing, so I'm not going to repeat some of that. But what I want us to look at, because we've heard about listening to the voice of God, it's the other way round now. It is God saying, listen to us. So this is a dual process of us listening and God listening. And it's the idea of what happens with the Hebrew word listen. So listen, O Israel, is basically pay attention, focus. In our family, we have constant, almost daily dialogue about whether one person in that family is listening or not. So Darcy would, or Dylan, they would be going out one night and they'd all be sort of getting ready to go out and said, where are you going? I've told you so many times, you never listen to me. I told you yesterday where I'm going. And it'll either be something like, you didn't listen, you didn't hear, or you forgot. It was never them that didn't actually tell us. It was us, me, that's got dementia and had forgotten about it, or Lorna, because she's 60 now and she can't hear. believe me, I know that. And so there's this dialogue between listening and hearing and acting. And so the idea, as we've touched on already, that listening in the Hebrew, hearing, is not just about paying attention and focusing. It's about responding. That's why it says, follow your Lord, your God, listen and obey. The strange thing is that in Hebrew, there isn't a separate word for obey. But the word listen in Hebrew, shema, is actually, actually captures the whole concept of paying attention, focusing, obeying, responding, and acting. So we have to put, as English translators, listen and obey, because we don't always get the whole sense that listen actually means obey. It's one word. It's one concept. And so when Lorna says, you're not listening to me, she's saying you're not obeying me. You're not acting according to what I've said. You're not responding to me. It isn't just going into my ears or then forgetting. It's actually me not responding to what she's saying. So listen and obey are one action. So we've got listen, and we've got love. So love. Love, obviously, within the understanding of the whole Bible, is something that we can't really go into. But love here is not the romantic love that we would necessarily think about when it comes to love. The covenant with God and Israel, as I've said last week, is shaped around treaty. It's a theological treaty, as I've said, between the suzerain and the vassal. And this treaty shapes all how we understand about the concept of love. Because we go to romantic desire, we go to eros, we go to emotion. But love in the language, the love language, if you like, of Deuteronomy is the language of loyalty, allegiance, and obedience. See, we all know each other's love language. My love language is licorice and Haribo. Yeah, yours is food. Yeah, so we've all got love language. We've all got things which make us desire something. It's also something that we hear and feel love for someone when they do an action or they give us something. Here, the love language of Deuteronomy is loyalty, it's allegiance. And that is why when love is pronounced as a call or a command, it feels a bit strange, because we know that love cannot be commanded. It cannot be coerced. And it cannot be compelled. I can't compel Lorna to love me. I just can't. But she loves me just because of the sheer magnitude of my personality. And, of course, she's dazzled by my big, shiny head. But I'll have you know, in 1991, it was my curly locks that she was dazzled by. Okay? Hard to believe, of course. But we know that love cannot be coerced, it cannot be commanded or compelled. We cannot be held hostage to love. So when we look at God saying, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, it looks strangely like something is compelling us to love. And we know that actually love doesn't work like that. But in the language of Deuteronomy, there is an emphasis of that. It's shaped by the cultural treaty of the ancient Near East. And that's why there is also the language of transaction involved in this process. That's not to mean that love within Deuteronomy is devoid of emotion. God himself says that he loves first, because it was the Lord that loved you and kept the oath he swore to your ancestors. that he brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the land of slavery, from the power of the Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know therefore that the Lord your God is God, his faithful God, keeping his covenant of love to 1,000 generations of those that love him and keep his commands. So it is God who is the OG of love. He's the original gangster of love. He's the prime mover of love. Okay? He's the one that moves towards us. And so therefore, love in terms of God, is the initiator of the covenant treaty. It isn't that he loves for the purpose of power over or political advantage, which was part of the treaty of the day, but God here, his love is seen to be different. So we have a loyalty love, an allegiance love, but from God to us, it's far more than just that. It is a love that is desirous. And God says, we have history together. So he's not an invading force giving them an ultimatum. Choose life looks like an ultimatum, of course, but we start to unpack it, and it's far deeper and broader than that. So we have all sorts of toxic rhetoric in the church about being called to love God. It loads us with a lot of baggage and with a lot of guilt sometimes, because we think we should be loving God more than we are at the moment. But this treaty covenant love helps us to realise that actually our love language for God is not always, and perhaps not even at the moment, shaped by warm, fuzzy feelings about God, emotion or desire. But loving God can be seen and enacted by a life of loyalty, a life of allegiance, a life of acting in the shape of Jesus. We may not feel like we're loving God, but actually our actions show us that we are, because they're actions of loyalty and allegiance to the character and the person of Jesus. And so we talk about love within Deuteronomy. It's based around life and loyalty. Our next word, heart. We've already talked about heart already this morning. In fact, we've sung it several times, haven't we, Akram? The whole idea of guarding our heart, cleaning our heart even. And one of the things Akram said this morning, he says that we're going to do some work with our hearts and our minds. And so already you make a division between our heart and our mind. And that is it's a true thing, but also it's a false dichotomy, because it divides up ourself. Because we have a complicated history with the word heart. We've asked Jesus into our hearts. Well, you may not have done, but you may have heard that language, of course. I love you with all my heart, we sing. Clean our hearts, guard our hearts. The thing is, ancient Israel had no word for the concept of the brain. All the brain's activity, which we would consider to be rational, intellectual thought, decision-making process, is located in the heart. So when Akram said, we're actually going to be thinking using our brain this morning, but also we're going to be engaging our heart, he needn't have said anything in a Hebrew context. He needn't have said anything about our brain, because as soon as someone heard about the heart, they know it's about the brain as well. It's about the decision-making process. It's about being wise. It's about growing in intellect and understanding. It's about shaping our minds and our thoughts. So when we love God with our heart, we are doing so actions of love, which is like a mind-brain activity. It is growing in knowledge of who God is. It is a richer and deeper understanding of the Christ-like portrait that God gives us. And so our heart is something different, perhaps, than we consider or shaped by our own culture or understanding. What about soul? We have a problem with soul as well. Soul is such a terribly loaded word. When you think about soul, what do you think of? Death? What else? I've told this story before, but I'll say it again. Many years ago, when I first became a Christian, we used to go along to the 6:30 gospel meeting. And this was a meeting where you'd have some kind of fiery preacher telling us how damned we were if we didn't become Christians. And there was one day, the particular preacher that was saying, "We're all sinful, dark people that have disobeyed God. Our souls are black." And there was this little kid on the front row that turned to his mate and said, "He said our souls." And I thought it was a lovely moment. It was probably the first time in the church or ever since that the word our souls had been heard in that church. But the word soul, actually, largely translated into English translators, is the word nephesh, which actually means life breath. Life breath. So murder in the Old Testament, you would be a nephesh slayer. If you kidnap some, you would be a nephesh thief. It is to limit life, to kill life, to end life, is to end breath. And so nephesh is not actually the immortality of the soul. It is not this disembodied ghost that we think of when our souls are levitating above ourselves and will end up being somewhere else when we die. Soul is almost the opposite. Soul is the life breath of us. It's related actually to the physicality of our bodies. It is our whole self and our whole being. And so when we read it in the English translations, we are loaded with these Greek myths about what soul is, but actually it's something closer to us than we imagine. It is the summary of our self, which includes our bodies. So we are to bring these two together and say, where are the allegiances of our essential self? Where does our whole self, to whom and to what does it give allegiance? To whom and to what does our body give loyalty? You see, to God, when our soul and nephesh is loving God, we are to love God using our body. So it is to embrace the life-giving habits and actions of our body. And we've talked about that, don't we? We've celebrated that already this morning. So that will be our eating habits, how we eat and with whom we eat. Because all of the loving Godness of the Shema is bound up in loving our neighbour. So when we eat through various forms of community and as individuals, but we also do things when we gather together that express ourselves. So dancing, the things that when Akram brings his dance group together, they are expressing a love for God in the physical form of dancing. When we choose that clothing that we put on, when we're playing football, when Charlie goes and looks after his snakes and his frogs that he's got, he's telling me about some frogs on Friday that you've got. When he's looking after them, when he's caring for them, when he's feeding them, what do you feed them, Charlie? Crickets, live crickets, yes. So he's going to bring them to church one day and we're going to love God with feeding his frogs some crickets. The whole idea is loving God with our soul, with our nephesh, is loving also God with our bodies and what we do. And it, particularly when those activities are life-giving, they're affirming life, they're giving life to our neighbours and to our enemies and to our friends. You see, God became who we are, our bodies. He was enfleshed, not to be against what we are, but to be with and for what we are. And Christians, sadly, have had a warped understanding of their bodies. The last one. So loving allegiance is a love of God using our heart, brain, body, equaling our whole self. Love God with our strength. 300 times strength is used, but it's not about muscle power. So you think somehow that I've got to love God and I've got to raise as much energy as I can, gritty. I've got to love God with my strength. And somehow it's this willpower that I've got to summon to love God. Love God is, and with all our strength, is actually using the word meyud, which means very or much. It's what is called an adverb. It is a word which enhances the intensity of another word. So God created the world and saw it was good. Then God created the world and said it was very good. It intenses the word good. It fulfills the capacity of the word. But of course, translators couldn't say, you've got to love God with all your muchness. It doesn't sound very nice. It's a bit like much of a muchness, sort of like bland and vanilla, and there's no distinction between the two. But that's what it is. So they put strength in as a way to describe it, but it doesn't fulfill what it's saying in totality. Because me'ud is a summary of so much more than just strength. It basically ends the shema. So we've got to love God with our heart, brain, body, our whole self, with all of our very muchness, with everything that we've got. But it's more than that, because it's about saying that your whole self, all of your human capacity, all of your possibility, all of your potential can be used to love God in an infinite number of ways. Everything our lives, every moment, every ability, every opportunity is the chance to love God and our neighbour. So very much is not just the willpower to be strong, it's the sphere of life where our whole selves love God. So it says there is no limit, therefore, to how and to where you show love for God and your neighbour. And there's an indication in the next few words that you would have understood here to be able to know where this was going. So after it says, love God with all your very muchness, it says, impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. The idea is that we think about writing the Shema on all the door frames and the beds and impress it upon the children and tell them again to remember this. You've got to remember that you've got to do this. It isn't just about texting and talking. It isn't about what you write and what you speak. It's about what you live. And so if the narrator was saying, look, you've got to impress upon your children, the next generations, where you read and recite the Shema, love God with all yourselves. But also, it's not about where you write it or where you speak it. It's where you live it. And here he's saying, you live it in parenting. You live it when you're walking and when you're staying at home. You live it when you're going on holiday. You live it when you're resting and when you're sleeping. It's about the times between morning and evening, when you're in your bed. It's the work of your hands, the symbols on your foreheads. It's how you dress, how you adorn yourself. It's the buildings that you inhabit. This is an expansive, broad view of how we love God with all ourselves and where we love God in all the spheres of life. And we have sadly so limited and made narrow both the type of love that we have for God and also where that love of God is to be expressed. There are no boundaries to Shema love. It is expansive, wild, deep and diverse. Two things I want to say before we finish. We can never outlive or outrun our love for God because it is determined by the limits of the God that we mentally imagine him to be. So how we love God and where we love God is in some ways governed by who we think God is. So if we imagine God to be an angry judge or a controlling tyrant, we may not only live in fear, but we may find it very hard to love God. If we think that God is generally a cosmic, distant, celestial being that's not really interested in us, we'll find it hard to be connected to God, emotionally attached to God. If we believe God is a benevolent Father Christmas or a cuddly granddad figure, it may be that we may be grateful and sentimental towards him, but actually we won't feel inclined to give loyalty, to conform to his character and to his will. The limits of how and where we love God is governed by those mental portraits of God. We'll only go as far as the depth, the beauty we imagine of God. And so when we find it hard to struggle with loving God, it may be that we need to do some work with our minds and with our hearts, same thing, on being able to nurture and nourish a new mental picture of God. Essentially, it means that our portrait of God needs to be changed. It needs to be disillusioned. We need to be disillusioned with God and disillusioned of God. That means that we need to be disillusioned of the lies we've been told about God. We need to be disillusioned of the false and fake portraits of God that have been told to us and that we have in our minds. We need to lose the illusion of God that we have inherited, learned, and adopted. And when we see, imagine, and understand and experience God as always looking like Jesus, we will then be able to explore very much the deep, broad, expansive possibilities of loving God with our whole self in all the spheres of life. And as I have said before a couple of times, as a sort of little benediction, I like these words, which says, God's posture towards the universe is always love. God's position in the universe is always towards. And God's personhood in the universe always looks like Jesus. And from that portrait, we then are able to love God with our whole selves and in all spheres of life. Let's pray.